tonight. To me, it's a fascinating section. It really starts way back in chapter 7. In chapter 7, the problem that the king of Judah was facing was the fact that the king of Israel and the king of Syria were plotting against him to oust him and set up somebody of their own as king in Jerusalem. And God told him it's not going to stand. In fact, do you remember the time frame of how long it would be before those two kings wouldn't be a threat? However long it took for a newborn child to learn the difference between right and wrong. And that's all he gave us. But you picked up the 3 years at the end of the Moab in chapter 16, that it would be 3 years, he says there in verse 14. We'll get to that in a minute. But we've got this intrigue going on in the political world. You got Israel as a nation, you got Judah as a nation, you got Syria as a nation, but you got the big bully sitting up in the northeast section called Assyria. And when the king of Judah decided he didn't trust God, but he thought it would be better to hire the king of Assyria, then the king of Assyria came in like a flood. Chapter 8 came in like a flood, and just all the nations, not just Judah, but all the nations would be impacted. We had some concerns or some promises at the end of chapter 8. We thrust into darkness, but chapter 9 says the land that was sitting in darkness would see a great light. Of course, that's quoted in Matthew 4 and applied to the ministry of Jesus. So we're dealing with long stretches of time and intervening difficulties that sometimes are prophetic in and of themselves, or if not prophetic, at least illustrative, illustrating what's going to happen. Chapter 10 deals with the cutting down of Israel by the axe called Assyria, but then with the promise that Assyria would be punished when it was done. Chapter 11, we bring in a promise of the Son who would judge and rule righteously. And so chapter 12 is a song of praise of that salvation. In verse 2, God, behold, God is my salvation. I will trust and not be afraid. So there's this song of praise about the salvation that would come when the child that was going to be born would be born. But until then, we've got the intrigue of the nations. We've got the invasion of Assyria really heavy on the horizon, impending invasion by Assyria. But like I said, Judah would not be the only one affected or impacted by the invasion. And so we started in chapter 13 and 14 about the rise and the ultimate downfall of whom? Not Israel. Chapter 13, 14.
That's the downfall of Assyria from Babylon.
Yeah, but he starts off talking about the king of Babylon.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the king of Babylon would take out Assyria, but the king of Babylon was also going to be taken out.
Yeah, by the Medes.
By the Medes. And so we have this chapters 13 and 14 dealing with the rise and fall of Babylon. God's plan is intact. Okay. So when we get to 15, which where we were last week, the devastation of Moab. Moab. Where is Moab? What is Moab?
Did it come on?
What? My message.
Again?
No.
Just directly east of the Dead Sea, south end of the Dead Sea to the middle of the Dead Sea on the eastern side, and Ammon was north of that. Lot's sons, Lot's incestuous sons. Were they his sons or his grandsons?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. sons by his daughters. Okay. So he starts with Moab, and we're going to look at, y'all got that page that I handed out that looks like this. Okay, look at the far right side, the far right side under section outline, and you'll see the breakdown there: Babylon, Moab, Damascus, Cush, Egypt, desert nations, Jerusalem, Tyre. We're talking about the impact of this judgment on the nations that are surrounding Jerusalem. So last week we looked in chapter 15 in the first half of 16 at the nation of Moab. Moab is an important nation from the standpoint of the Davidic lineage. You remember that? That Ruth the Moabitess became the father of Obed, who became the father of Jesse, who was the father of David, the most spectacular king of Judah, Israel, still a combined nation at that time, and a place where David, when he was fleeing from Saul, would take his parents for protection so that Saul couldn't somehow extort David by fighting his parents. So Moab was important, but they were also clustered in a great deal of pride. So now let's remember a little bit about Moab in chapters 15 and 16 before we get into the text in chapter 16 and 17 that we want to look at. It says in verse 1 of 15, surely a night Kerr of Ar of Moab and Kerr of Moab, those are two of the big cities, two of the key cities, are devastated, ruined. They have gone, this is the point, verse 2, the point I wanted you to see. They've gone up to the temple and to Dibon, to the high places. What's a high place? And don't think of that elevation. Think of high in the sense of holy or sacred.
Place high of worship.
Idol worship.
Yeah, generally it would be maybe in a grove or some kind of place that would just look, it just draws you to God. And so they would make, but it's idolatry. Moab wails over Nebo and Medeba. They've gone to the temple to pray, and they're moaning. Verse 7, the abundance they have acquired and stored up, they carry off. So whatever loot that or national treasure. Oh, Gandhi, what's at Fort Knox? Do you know Fort Knox? Who knows what's at Fort Knox?
Gold.
It's the storehouse of the nation's gold. To back the monetary system. So I'm not going down that road. I'm just drawing your attention to nations store things. Okay?
That there's more in gold.
No, yeah, because it's so well defended. But the point I'm getting at is nations will store, and we have massive oil reserves too, don't we? Massive cheese reserves somewhere, and wheat and other things. Okay? Moab had massive reserves, but they're being carried away across the brook to somebody else. So the massive reserves were not a protection. The idols that they worshiped were not a protection. And it says in verse 9, the waters of Dibon are full of blood. There's a lion upon the fugitives of Moab. That's kind of interesting. What's a fugitive? One who is on the run, one who's fleeing, okay? And so they're being chased out of the cities, and there's lions. He's talking about literal lions. And there were a lot of them in the Jordan Valley, or figurative lions, those who would take advantage of people running for their lives. Okay, and that's what he's saying is happening to Moab. And so what was the answer that we saw last week that was given to Moab regarding this challenge or this difficulty of their life. I mean, their stores are gone, their gods are failing them, they're running for their lives and beings. What should they do? Pardon?
Return.
Verse 1. Send a lamb. What's a lamb?
Sacrifice.
Okay. To where? To the mountain of the daughter of Zion. You want protection in this life. It's not going to be your national reserves. It's not going to be your isolated position. It's not going to be your idol gods. It's going to be whoever is ruling from Mount Zion. So send a sacrifice to him. Verse 4, let the outcast of Moab stay with you. This is the plea. The outcast of Moab, where are we going to go? Well, go to Mount Zion and stay there. Be a hiding place to them from the destroyer. Now, what's the point for me? What's the intent? What can I, like Scott pray, what can I draw from this? That's not I drop. I draw from this. But
you could do the same thing.
Do the same thing. What do you mean?
We humble ourselves and draw ourselves to God.
We really don't need Greenland, do we?
No.
We don't need to have keep Russia or China out of Greenland so that we will stay safe. That's not what we need to do. What do we need to do? Turn to God. Bring your sacrifices to the throne of God. Right? And that's the point I want us to see in this information. That nations have tried things that don't work. Why should we repeat their mistakes? Why not listen to what the prophet says is where security really is? That's what I love about this section that we're in. Because it debunks all the things that nations put their trust in. Saying, it doesn't work, that doesn't work, that doesn't work. But bring your sacrifice to Zion and find refuge there. That'll work. Okay? Linda, you had a thought.
Paradise fire, the church of the nails are really standing, so it's kind of to go there.
And that's not the point. It's not, the point is, you go to Jesus. And not go to this denomination, that's not the point. The point is go to Jesus, because he is the ruler in the house of David, and go to Jesus. Yeah, he is. Okay. All right. Any thought? That's where we got to last week. And so 15, 16, 18 minutes to review is probably the right amount. Here's another problem, and we're going to start now in verse 6. We have heard of the pride of Moab, an excessive pride. His arrogance, pride, and fury, his idle hope are false. Yes?
Can you try turning your microphone around? You are really muffled, but Michael comes through really clear.
Yeah, okay. I don't know what to tell you. I've got it right here in front of me.
Okay. It's still coming through.
I don't know if there's a button on here that I can push to increase the volume. It looks like maybe try this. I don't know if that's going to work. Says I'm up to 100% volume, but that might be feedback rather than input. I might have to.
I had to put my headphones on to be able to hear.
Oh,
I may have used this one so much that I've worn it out. I'll see about getting a new one. Anyway, I'm going to unplug this and use the computer mic. Give me feedback now. Can you hear me better or worse?
About the same.
All right. Okay, so I'll plug that one back in because it's more omnidirectional. I'll speak up a little bit. Maybe, I don't know if you can turn your volume up, your listening volume up, or Mary says she's putting headphones on to do it. Sorry about that. Okay, verse 6. We have heard of the pride of Moab, an excessive pride, of his arrogance, pride, and fury. His idle boasts are false. Somebody is boasting about what they can do or what how defensible they are, or how protected they are, or how immune they are to the impending invasion by Assyria and especially Babylon. They won't get us. We're off to the side. We're out of the mainstream. We got places we can hide. You know, yada, yada, yada. So an excessive pride in our ability to withstand whatever is coming. Therefore, Moab shall wail. Every one of Moab shall wail. You shall moan for the raisin cakes of Kir-Hareseth. You shall, all those, as those who are utterly stricken, for the fields of Heshbon. Now, these are names of the cities or the districts, because a city would be surrounded by its fields, right? The fields of Heshbon have withered. The vines of Sibmah, the lords of the nations, have trampled down its choice clusters. What's that talking about? The vineyards, the wheat fields, and trampled down by the lords of the nations. So the invading armies, I don't care about your vineyard. It's in my way. I'll just trample it down. Or I don't want you to have it. If I can starve you out, you're easier, more easily conquered. These clusters, which reached as far as Jazer, wandered to the deserts. Its tendrils spread themselves out, passed over the sea. Now, what's a tendril? I got a question mark to myself. It's tendril. The tendrils are not the fruit-bearing aspect of the vine, are they?
Grabs.
Why does it grab? What's it trying to do?
Expand itself.
To support. And so I'm reaching over here for support, and I'm reaching over here for support. It's a figure of that an agrarian society, a grape growing society, would understand that the reason this heavy cluster of grapes doesn't fall to the ground is because the plant has a tendril holding it to a vine. Okay? It's support. So the picture is Moab reaching across the sea for support. Somebody help me. See? It's not going to work. Therefore, I will weep bitterly for Jazer, for the vine of Sibmah. I will drench you with my tears, O Heshbon and Ileala, for the shouting over your summer fruits and your harvest has fallen away. Shouting over your summer fruits.
It's going to be a harvest festival.
Harvest festival. Rejoicing. It's fallen away. And gladness and joy are taken away from the fruitful field. In the vineyards also there will be no cries of joy or jubilant shouting. No treader treads out wine in the presses. I have made the shouting to cease. Wait, hold on, stop. Put your brakes on. I thought he was talking about what was going to happen when Assyria and or Babylon came through and devastated this way, but he says, I did it. I did this. Can you imagine Assyria coming in without God's permission? Can you? And in fact, in chapter 10, what did God say to Assyria? Chapter 10.
He would be their tool to just.
You are my tool, and why are you boasting about what you did? Yeah, should the axe boast itself against the guy who's wielding the axe? I mean, I've seen guys at the Puyallup Fair cutting through a block of wood with an axe. And I know I could take the same axe and do nothing like what they could do with the axe. It's not the axe. It's the wielder of the axe that makes the difference. See, it might look like Assyria doing it with God's eye. Do you see that right there in verse 10? 16:10? I have made the shouting disease. It's me doing this. It's me doing this. When we get to chapter 19, we're going to see something that will really illuminate thoughts from the New Testament about the Lord coming on a swift cloud. As soon as I say that about the New Testament, you're thinking what? The Lord's coming on a swift cloud. What do you think? Jesus at the end of time, right?
No, and, Jesus. He said that he's coming with clouds.
Yeah, but the majority of American people think when you hear that, they think you're talking about Jesus coming on a cloud at the end of time. And yet God said in Isaiah 19:1, I am coming to Egypt on a swift cloud. And it was what? The Babylonian army. When he says, here, I have made it cease. How did he make it cease? The Babylonian army. Okay? But he took credit for it.
Yeah, Jesus said, I'm coming on a cloud to Caiaphas.
Yeah. Well, that was my point. When we take the New Testament in isolation, we put a different meaning on the words than the Bible writers put on it. Okay? The Bible writers are talking about a judgment sponsored by God through the agency of the emperor of the time. Okay, enough about that. We'll talk more about that when we get to 19. I just wanted to emphasize that when he says, I have made shouting to cease, he didn't do it personally. He did it through the agency of the invading army. Therefore, my heart intones like a harp for Moab, and my inward feelings for Kir-Hareseth. So it will come about. Now, so here's, does God like punishing people? Does he take pleasure in punishing people? Now, he does it because it's required, it's necessary, it's needed. But he says, I take no pleasure in the death of the wicked. Why will you die? And so here, my intones, it breaks God's heart that that's the way Moab is. They don't have to be like that. They could bring the lamb to the king on the throne. They could do that if
Rod,
they would. Yes.
That word intones, I guess I'm just not real familiar with it. It means it's a sadness, my heart. What? Give me another word for intones.
Give us another word for intones. Moans, weeps.
Okay.
Is it harmony with the sad music? Is it
okay.
in harmony with the sad music, maybe?
Thank you.
That's in verse 11. Therefore, my heart intones like a harp from Moab. That's the New American Standard. Okay? And my inward feelings. See, Mary, one of the ways you can get there is see the parallel is my heart intones my inward feelings. It moans. That's one of the words that I used. Okay. So it will come about. So it will come about when Moab presents himself, when he wearies himself upon his high place and comes to his sanctuary to pray. Look at those three phrases. He presents himself, he wearies himself. You remember the prophets at the contest on Mount Carmel? How they danced and they pranced and they gashed themselves. They just wearied themselves, drove themselves to the point of weariness, trying to invoke the gods to come and burn up the sacrifice. Of course, it didn't happen. When he wearies himself, it gets to the idea of the religious frenzy that sometimes you see among pagans. Sometimes you see it even among Pentecostals, a religious frenzy, as though you're going to invoke God that way. When he wearies himself upon his high place and comes to his sanctuary to pray, he'll not prevail. Assyria is coming anyway, so is Babylon, and there's not a god in Moab that can stop. Okay. So what's the answer? Bring the lamp to the ruler of the land, to the wilderness, from the wilderness to the mountain of the daughter of Zion. Verse 1. Okay, any thoughts on that? Last couple of verses. This is the word which Yahweh spoke earlier concerning Moab. But now Yahweh speaks, saying, within 3 years, as a hired man would count them, the glory of Moab will be degraded along with all his great population, and the remnant will be very small, impotent. How does a hired man count 3 years? Within 3 years, as a hired man would count them. Doesn't he try to shave as much off the front side and back side of that as possible? You know, 15 minutes before closing time, we're starting to pack up and just get to the punch out clock. Okay? We're shutting down early, okay? Where it should be. Punch out at punch out time, then pick up your tools and go home. Now we're gonna get as much out of the guy and offer as little work as possible. Within 3 years, as a hired man would count them. You see, it's not going to be a full 3 years. In other words, it's a short period of time before everything that Moab boasts about is going to be cleaned up and gone. And it will be a remnant, not a remnant. How much of a remnant? Yeah, that's what the remnant would be, but very small. Piquito. That's what he said? All right. Now, chapter 17 deals with Damascus. All right, so I'm going to ask us about Damascus. What is Damascus? It's Damascus.
The capital.
Yeah, the capital of Syria. Capital city of Syria. Now, where has Syria come into our attention? Not Assyria. Those are totally different people. Syria and Assyria are two different nations. The capital of Assyria is Nineveh. Capital of Syria, Damascus. And they're quite a ways away.
Syria.
Yeah, Syria is a neighbor, northern neighbor of Israel. Okay.
But they were, didn't they get in league with the 10 tribes?
They got in league with Israel to overthrow the king of Judah in chapter 7.
Why he went to Assyria.
Which is why the king of Judah, Ahab, went to Assyria, okay, for help rather than to God for help. But here now, we're, I know you remember this, Alan. If you will not believe, you will not stand. Remember, God told Ahab when he's thinking about hiring Assyria, I'll take care of you, but if you won't believe, you won't stand. And he hired Assyria anyway, and of course he didn't stand. But Assyria, Damascus, was one of the two that Ahab in chapter 7 was worried about. To hear God's pronouncing judgment against them. The oracle. What does the word oracle mean? Burden. Damascus, you're going to have to carry the weight of this pronunciation. You're going to have to carry the weight of that. Ever feel the weight of some pronouncement? My heart break for Emmy. I mean, about 2 months ago, her 20-year-old son got a 19-year prison sentence. I'm not all the details. But that was a pronouncement that is heavy on the heart. That is hard. It's the burden. See, the oracle, the burden. That's a pronouncement that's hard to carry. So the oracle concerning Damascus, behold, Damascus is about to be removed from being a city, and it will become a fallen ruin. The cities of Aroer are forsaken. They will be for flocks to lie down in. Now, the cities of Aroer are not huge by today's standards, but what would you think if heard from God that the city of Auburn was going to be a grazing place for sheep and cattle? What would that mean to you? The city of Auburn is going to become a grazing ground for sheep and cattle. What does that mean? Drastic change from what it is now. A lot of tearing up of infrastructure to happen. Okay? A lot of devastation. Nature has a way of taking over just about any piece of the property, does it? And so all you're going to have is your livestock grazing where you used to live, where you used to run your commerce. Okay? And there will be no one to frighten them. That is, nobody shoo the cattle off that piece of ground. Get out of my yard! Nobody there to do that. The fortified city will disappear from Ephraim. Now, what did we just do with that verse?
Israel.
We went to the 10 northern tribes. See, in chapter 7, the two nations that Ahab was worried about was Syria and Israel. Capital cities, Ephraim, or Damascus and Ephraim. And here, that's not going to happen because this guy is coming in. A king would be the first one. It was Assyria that took Israel captive, wasn't it, in 721.
Rod?
The fortified city will disappear from Ephraim and sovereignty from Damascus. And the remnant from Aram. Aram was the area. In fact, you've probably heard of the Abraham was called from Ur of the Chaldeans, but he went from there up to Haran, which is the Aramean Islands. Aram. Yeah. Aram is up at the headwaters of the
Aramean language.
The language comes from there, but the headwater of the Euphrates River is basically where we're talking about, which is even further east than just justice. Yes, Linda?
So the remnant of Syria
Syria and Aram are used interchangeably. They will be like the glory of the sons of Israel. What was the glory of the sons of Israel? They were hauled off into captivity. Hauled into captivity, declares Yahweh hosts. Now it will come about in that day. What day? The day that the glory of the sons of Israel will be diminished. The day that Damascus will cease being a city. The day that the fortified city will disappear from Ephraim. In that day, what would be the invasion of Assyria? That's what brought the devastation on Syria and Israel. It was the invasion. And in fact, when we watch chapters 38 and 39, we'll see, and we even saw in chapter 8, that the Assyrian invasion came right up to the neck, right up to the capital city called Jerusalem of Judah. Okay, not God, at the prayer of Hezekiah, defeated the Assyrian out in the field, Judah would have gone under as well. But it was 100 years later when the Babylonian did their thing on Judah. But Israel to the Assyrian, and so did Damascus. And it will come about in that day that the glory of Jacob will fade and the fatness of his flesh will become lean. What does that mean? Fatness of his flesh will become lean. I think there is figurative and literal tied up in that one. Individually, yeah, the starvation, the siege would reduce the population to skin and bones. But all, then the, what do they call it, GDP, gross domestic product, would go way down, say. So,
like the grapes and Moab.
Yeah. It will be even like the reaper gathering the standing grain as his arms the ears, or it'll be like one gleaning ears of grain in the valley of Ephraim. What is gleaning? Anybody know gleaning?
Picking up, yes.
Is that what happens when you polish something off?
No.
When
it's
you
picking
back,
up the grain, getting the grain, harvesting the grain, the good pieces.
Going back a second time after the harvest has been accomplished. And what's left? It's been harvested. Now, the sad part about the harvest is not good news for Israel. It's one that cuts them down. And so, but it will be like one gleaning ear in the valley of Ephraim. Yet, gleanings will be left in it like the shaking of an olive tree, two or three olives on the topmost branch. You know, an interesting thing about fruiting trees is that when they blossom, they don't all just blossom instantly at the same time. It might stretch out over 2 days, maybe a week, maybe more than a week, where you got some late bloomers. If that's the case, then what about late ripeners? Pardon?
They could only pick
one. Yeah, and God said you could only pick once, and then after that, everything else is for the poor and the needy to glean. Okay? So there will be gleanings left. After the harvest of Damascus and Israel, there will be some fruit left. And I think this is God's way of saying those that weren't taken will be still there for me. 4 or 5 on the branches of a fruitful tree, declares God of Israel, in that day. So we're going to have 2 or 3 in that days. We had it up in verse 4. We're going to have it here again in verse 9, and verse 7, then again 9. In that day, that same day that we're talking, verse 4, which is connected to verses 1 through 3, in that day, verse 7, man will have regard for his maker, and his eyes will look to the Holy One of Israel, and he will not have regard for the altars, the work of his hands, nor will he look to that which his fingers have made, even the Asherim and the incense stands. Tell me about that. That is one of the most significant things that we've read tonight. Very important. Now, Ed, where God says, my heart weeps for Moab. Well, this is not Moab, this is Damascus. But God is not partial. So his sadness over what had to happen to Moab is also a sadness over what's having to happen to Damascus, and especially Israel, Abraham's offspring.
Right.
So you know that the devastation was not pleasant to God. But what does verse 7 and 8 suggest to you in that regard?
Now they're thinking about him.
Now they're thinking about him. Isn't it interesting? And think about this for your own life. That all the blessings that God had blessed these people with, they were using, according to Jeremiah and other prophets, they were using for the idols. They were sacrificing to the idols, and they were saying that this stuff comes from that. All the God weren't good enough to anchor their hearts to God. But as soon as he started punishing them, they said, oh, we need to turn back to God. Now, I don't want it to have to happen in your life, that the goodness of God is enough to draw you to him, that it takes his discipline. And he, you know, what did the Hebrew writer say? That he disciplines every child he receives. If God didn't care about what I'm doing, then he wouldn't get involved, blockage in my way or in some other hedging up my way or reprimanding me or punishing me for the mistake making, not to punish, but to change my heart. Exactly. Father who cares for his child, I care about you too much to let you keep doing that. And he says, in that day, they will have regard to me. In other words, this is not capricious on the part of God. This is addictive on the part of God. This story, I want to bring back the people whose hearts reach. In that day, verse 9, their strong cities will be forsaken places in the forest, or like branches which have they have abandoned before the sons of Israel. And the land will be a desolation. So your land is going to be torn up and your crops are going to fail and you're going to be overrun by the enemy and you're going to be few in number, but those who are left will have me as their reward. In that day, and the day, you know, I skipped over verse, I want to do that. For, verse 10, for you have forgotten the God of your salvation and have not remembered the rock of your refuge. What's the word for? For. Why is there a for at the beginning of verse 10? Because they're happening as a result of your choices. For you have forgotten me. That's why bad things are happening to you. You have not remembered the rock of your refuge. You haven't looked and said, this is where I can hide. This is where I'll be protected. This is where, and isn't that what I said? If you will not believe, you will not stand. You forgot what I can do for you. You forgot what I've done for you. People, this is one of the reasons why regular, systematic Bible reading is so important. Because it keeps in our minds fresh what God has done for us. God has done in the past. I mean, praise of God with Abraham, and a ram appears in a bush when he's about to take the life of his son. God will provide. And the more we keep in mind the things that God has done, the less we're likely to abandon. And that's the point he's making here. You have not remembered. You have forgotten. Therefore, you plant delightful plants and set them out with vine and set them with vine slips of a strange God. You get this? You're going to grow some vine, some vintage, and you can offer it to a strange God. But the harvest will be a heap. In a day of sickliness and incurable pain. What do you make out of that? I guess that's kind of what we've already said.
It kind of makes me scared about today.
Kind of makes you scared about today. I have no fear because I know what John said in 1 John 4:18. Perfect love casts out fear. I'm not afraid. I love God. He loves me.
Concerned, man.
Yeah. For other people, it's good to be concerned for other people.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, there's not a thing in the world I can do to change things by worrying about it. I can't change things. They're too big. But God can. So perfect love casts out fear. Let's close out with this. 12. 13 and 14. Alas, the uproar of many peoples who roar like the roaring of the seas, and the rumbling of nations who rush on like the rumbling of many waters. If you've ever wondered about passages that seem maybe figurative, that talk about a flood, the rains came down, the floods came up. We talking about like what we had here? I mean, was Jesus talking about like what we had here a month ago? Nope. He was talking about the flood of a nation. We saw it in chapter 8, didn't we? In chapter 8, Assyria overflowed its banks like a flood into Palestine. Here is very clear. The uproar of many people who roar like the roaring of the seas and the rumbling of nations who rush on of many waters. God has, say, in the book of Daniel, chapter 7, Daniel saw, let me just turn over there. Daniel 7, this is one of those visions that Daniel had of the four kingdoms that were coming, the Babylonian, Medo-Persian, Grecian, and Roman. But let me read, and says it was in verse 1 in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. But in verse 2, Daniel said, I was looking in my vision by night. Behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another. What was the sea that was being stirred up? Or more generic than the nation,
Wasn't the
the world population, out of which things rise and fall. But the world population, say, when for example, when Assyria fell, the populace of Assyria did not disappear. The rulership of them changed. Babylonian subjects, but they didn't change. So, with the turmoil that caused Assyria to fall and Babylon to rise, that was like the stirring up of the water. And out of that came the Babylonian Empire. That's what Daniel is seeing there in Daniel 7. Says, I saw the wind stirring it up and four great beasts. What's the beast? Empires. You come to the book of Revelation, the beast, an empire, the Roman Empire. Okay? And so, drawing from the old, the new is saying, but here's this mass of humanity out of which rise nations. And I look at it kind of like a lava lamp. Always changing with the same stuff. Okay? And so here, the sea beast in Revelation 13, you have the sea beast and the land beast, both of whom were controlled by Satan. I believe a study of the book of Revelation, and Devin will back me up on this, the study of the book of Revelation will show that the sea beast was the Roman Empire, the land beast was the Jewish false teachers, the Jewish religious hierarchy, both of whom were persecuting Christians. But the sea beast, okay? Here, who rush on like many waters. We saw that in Isaiah 8. The Assyrian Empire was this flood. In Revelation 12, where the beast, the dragon, sent a flood of water to destroy the woman, but the land, i.e. Israel, swallowed it up. It's the Roman Empire coming in as a flood and overflowing the nation, capturing, destroying Jerusalem. But that focus of the Roman effort to destroy Jerusalem allowed the Christians to escape. Satan wanted to destroy the bride of Christ. God directed it to the woman he was divorced. Anyway, all of that is undergirded by this one verse right here that shows how we're using the idea of the peoples being like the seas. Okay? The nations, verse 13, the nations rumble on like the rumbling of many waters, but he, grabbing hold of this one, but he will rebuke them and they will flee away. I want to think again about what I just said about Revelation 12, where the dragon spewed a mighty river whose intent was to destroy God's bride. But the earth, the land of Israel, helped the woman by swallowing the flood. It engulfed it. Why was it that God's people weren't destroyed, even though Satan would do that? Why was it that Israel was destroyed, even though that wasn't Satan's target? Look at this verse. But he will rebuke them. They will flee away. The nations were coming to destroy. And God was using it. But then, like in chapter 10, where Assyria was not wanting to do God's will, just wanting to capture loot and property, God says, when I'm finished punishing my people, I will rebuke them and they'll be gone. And so he says, he would be chased like chaff in the mountain before the wind. Can you just picture that? Now, we don't do a lot of threshing of wheat this side of the mountain. A lot of it done in the Palouse country of southeastern Washington on into Idaho. And it's interesting to watch the combines go through the field, because behind the combine there's just this cloud of debris, the chaff, which the wind just carries away. So God says, or Isaiah says, the nations that are coming to devastate, I will rebuke them at the proper time, and they'll be like the chaff in the wind. You know what the chaff is, don't you?
Rod?
Yes, Mary?
It reminds me of when I was cleaning out my onion seeds. I'd take a handful of the onions and the husk, the seeds, and I would drop it with the wind blowing. The seeds would fall to my tray, and all that chaff, the husk of this that was around the seed, all the debris, the wind would just carry away, and I was left with just the seed, and all the debris was washed away with the breeze.
So if I can rephrase that, you kept the part you wanted to keep, and you blew away the part that was throwaway.
Correct.
Okay. So the chaff before the wind is the throwaway part. I have no further use for this. Whirling dust before a gale. At evening time, behold, there's terror, but before morning, they are no more. You got the darkness, evening time, maybe the sun is going down on the nation. So it's terrible. But morning comes and they're gone. The nations that rise up and terrify people are God's beck and call. What to do is say, morning, they're gone. Such will be the portion of those who plunder us, and the lot of those who pillage us. Why is that true? That's what's going to happen to people who plunder God's people. Why is that true?
God.
That's it. That's it, right there. Because of God. Because God loves us. We are his treasure. And though he will allow discipline to come into our lives, I know what Paul said. God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able. No temptation is allowed by God that is too strong for you to bear. Now, whether you bear it, that's your choice. But God intends it to be for, what did we say earlier? He's going to use it to restore. They will look to their Holy One and no longer have regard for the junk in their lives. He uses it to change our hearts, to change our focus. Okay, next week, chapter 18. I forget exactly what I have laid out as far as the scheduling. I think it's 18, and then we'll get all of 18 and 19. Pardon?
19.
Yeah, 19 is kind of long, but it's all kind of involved. And I don't have my notes here in order, so I don't have the schedule here in order either. It's on our website, but I don't have the website up either. So I'm clambering on, hoping I can find it before I just say, okay, I'm not going to find it. And then we'll just have to look where I found it. I found it 18:1 through 19:15, halfway through 19. And I chose it that way just because of the time necessary, that much material. 18:1 through 19:15. Next, any thoughts or final comments?
Gaza looks a bit like
Pardon?
Gaza looks a bit like God's judgment, but I don't think they're seeing close to God for that whole situation.
You know, that's an interesting observation going on in the nations around us today. That if the nations, the people of the nations, would open the book and say, what's happening to us, instead of taking in their leaders or at the world leaders or blaming somebody else, if they would quit doing it and start saying, why, where, like Elihu said to Job, nobody says, where is God my maker? You're not asking the right questions. You're looking to blame or whatever, you'll escape responsibility. I'm impressed with Daniel 9. Daniel realized that the 70 years of captivity was up, and he started to pray. Now, there's very people in the world who have nothing negative said about them. When Daniel was, 90 years old, they tried to find something wrong with him so that they could feed him to the lions. They couldn't. They couldn't. No problem. Nothing was said derogatory about Daniel. Nothing was said derogatory about Joseph. Nothing about Jesus either. Everybody else had a problem. And yet Daniel in Daniel 9 said, he started to say, my sin and the sin of my people. He was owning that there was problems in his life. I know what New Testament says, all have sinned and fall short. There are problems. But Daniel, as good a man as he was owning the fact that he needed repentance. A lot of people will say, it's not my fault. And the people who say, it's not my fault, it's their fault. It's those Israelis who came in and took over our land all those years ago. It's their fault. Rather than saying, what kind of person am I that would microwave a baby? Like, what kind of person am I that would put up with that? Rather than that kind of question. Now, this is a good observation. Right? But all of this is about personally owning my relationship with God, and what is it about me I need to fix? Because I can't fix President Trump. I couldn't fix President Biden either. They both probably need a lot of fixing. But the only one I can work on is me, and I need God's help with that. So.
And we're talking to the always seems like I'm trying to say, he could say, it could be God says, just God can allow the Indian defense force to do so, because
I don't want it. That's just too convoluted. I want to say it simply. I need to be responsible for my relationship with God. That's what I need to be responsible for.
Yes.
All right, we're going to stop there. Go ahead, somebody.